from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In 1981, the first AIDS cases came quietly onto the public health scene in Los Angeles. The patients were six gay men. 25 years later, the disease is still wreaking havoc on the gay community, now with the possibility of a new super AIDS virus on the way. But time and drugs have also bred a return of desperately unsafe sex. Tonight on Point, new angst over AIDS and gay America debating more radical intervention to confront the epidemic. But first tonight, we turn to Washington, where Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan testified today before the Senate Banking Committee on the state of the U.S. economy and the highly charged issue of Social Security reform. Greg Gipp covers the economy for the Wall Street Journal. I asked him to give us the thrust of Greenspan's testimony.
Greenspan basically told us things look good on both the economic front and on the inflation front. He said the economic fundamentals have steadied and that inflation remains well contained. What he didn't tell us is exactly what he's going to do with interest rates. Now, that's a little bit of a break from what he's been doing in recent years, because under their new policy of transparency, they've been dropping broad hints about where interest rates are headed. Most recently, they were saying they would raise them at a measured pace. He didn't actually use that wording today, and that leads me to wonder whether they're a little bit less sure about what they're going to be doing with interest rates at their next few meetings.
That is, whether they'll continue to tick them up in small ticks as they have recently?
Well, I think that they probably will continue to raise interest rates, but I don't know whether they're as certain that they'll be doing it at a quarter point per meeting. They could go faster, they could go slower. I think the overall message that came out of Greenspan's testimony today on the economy is that he's just a lot less certain about what's going to happen over the next year. The baseline forecast looks pretty good, but there are more uncertainties around that than usual.
And what about the big political issues? Social Security reform, tax rates? What did Mr. Greenspan have to say?
I think Greenspan obviously got a lot of questions about Social Security, which is the big debate in Washington these days. And I think he gave a pretty solid, albeit cautious, endorsement of President Bush's plan to move to private accounts. His main message was, first of all, is that the challenge facing the country is to increase savings overall, savings of households, savings of the government. The main way to do that is to cut the government budget deficit and to find a way to put the big entitlement programs like Social Security and Medicare on a fully funded, solvent footing. And the point he made was that private accounts in and of themselves don't really boost saving. They just really move it from the government sector to the private sector. But that said, he thinks that the overall idea of private accounts is a good one because it's a form of a fully funded pension plan as opposed to the pay-as-you-go plan that we have today.
But I'm reading here that he signaled that he may want to see that reform happen more cautiously, more gradually than President Bush is suggesting.
Yeah. Now, he was asked about, well, what about the big costs of financing this transition? Because essentially, to create the private accounts, President Bush would direct a lot of workers' payroll taxes into these private accounts, but that would rob the government of revenue that it otherwise needs to support all sorts of other programs, such as benefits to existing retirees. So they would have to borrow that money, and the figure that they've been putting out there is over $700 billion in the coming 10 years. So there's a big question. Well, if the government has to borrow all that money, what does it do to interest rates? And Greenspan said, well, frankly, we don't know. And so that would be a good reason to move gradually in this in the introduction of these accounts.
Senator Richard Shelby, Alabama Republican, asked him if the personal accounts could be created without substantial borrowing. And he said, Mr. Greenspan, well, obviously, if you raise taxes, you could do that.
That's right. Greenspan said you could raise taxes. And then Shelby said, well, you could also cut benefits. And Greenspan, yes, you can do that, too.
Did he appear to be saying that the government should do one of those things rather than simply borrow the money to cover the transition?
No, and in fact, I think one of the frustrating aspects of his testimony is that on the very key issue of how you bring the system into solvency, which we all know cannot be done with private accounts alone, he didn't really give us a lot of his own opinions. I mean, he said there are ways of, you can do it this way, you can do it that way, but he didn't really give us a strong signal one way or the other what he would do.
Greg, Alan Greenspan is now in what, something like, most likely, the final year of his time as head of the Federal Reserve. Is he on a glide path? Is he a lame duck in any sense at this point?
I don't see that at all, Tom. I mean, he's well in control of the Federal Open Market Committee. I mean, he seems to have a very good handle on what to do with interest rates. I did not see any diminishment of the respect that congressmen have for him at the hearing today. And I think it's important to note that there is yet to be an obvious successor for him. And so when you don't really have any knowledge of who the next person is, that the authority of the existing candidate is unaffected.
Remind us what it is that governs Alan Greenspan's departure date as chairman of the Fed.
Well, the law says that when you're a governor of the Federal Reserve, which Mr. Greenspan is, you can't serve for more than 14 years. Now, he started in 1987, finishing off his predecessor Paul Volcker's term. So he got a brand new 14-year term in 1992, but that expires on January 31st, 2006. And he can't stay past that date unless, for some reason, the White House has been unable to get a replacement confirmed.
So Alan Greenspan, in his final full years, everyone's still all ears, but it won't last forever now. Greg Ipp, thanks a lot for being with us tonight.
Always a pleasure, Tom.
Greg Ipp covers the economy for the Wall Street Journal. He spoke with me from Washington. With the introduction of powerful new antiretroviral drugs, the number of AIDS deaths plummeted in the 90s. It was a cause for celebration. But HIV infection did not stop spreading. Now, with reports of new drug-resistant AIDS superviruses hitting the headlines, a familiar fear runs cold through the gay community once more. Gay activists say it is time to take the battle against unsafe sex and AIDS to a new level, to finally stop the unprotected, anonymous sex that can drive the disease, to take responsibility and rein in the AIDS pandemic, perhaps with radical intervention to clamp down on lethal, unsafe sex. Tonight on Point, a new debate in the gay community about AIDS intervention. You can join the conversation. What is the responsibility of the gay community to itself tackle the AIDS crisis? Is it time to track carriers, name names, crack down on sex that can kill? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is playwright and AIDS activist Larry Kramer. His play, The Normal Heart, about the early years of AIDS, has had over 600 productions around the world. His play, The Destiny of Me, was awarded an Obie. In November, he gave an epical speech at Cooper Union in New York entitled The Tragedy of Today's Gays. That speech is still sending shockwaves through the gay community. It will be published in April. Larry Kramer, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack. Good to have you.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Mr. Kramer.
Hello, Jack.
Larry Kramer, you came out in November with an incredible kind of cry from the heart about the circumstance of gays politically in this country, but also about gays in relationship to HIV/AIDS. You said you are still murdering each other to a crowd of many gay men. What did you mean, and what are you suggesting?
Well, very plain what I meant. What does it mean to you? Incidentally, please don't call it a pandemic. That's a stupid word. It's a plague. It's been called a plague now by Dr. Anthony Fauci, ahead of all the AIDS stuff at the NIH. It hasn't been a pandemic since practically 1982. I don't know why that word is used.
It's out there, but fine. Plague as you like it. I guess what it means to me when you say you're still murdering each other is that gay sexual activity has not changed enough to take into account the lethality of AIDS.
When you don't use a condom and have sex, you are, in essence, murdering another person. I think we have to start taking responsibility for that. We've known that this was a virus since 1984. From 1981 to 1984, you could say we didn't know what was going on here. But after 1984, when we were told it definitely was a virus, people simply did not listen, and they still don't listen, and I don't, for the life of me, know why they don't listen, and I don't see any kind of anything doing the trick anymore in terms of prevention. Our prevention activities since the very beginning have been a complete and utter failure. You only have to realize that 70 million people around the world are now infected. Doesn't sound to me like our prevention efforts have worked. All of these new plans that a bunch of people are coming up with now, quite frankly, don't sound any more effective than what's out there now. In fact, they seem to me harder to realize and a lot more work involved in getting certain data. I think we have lost the war against AIDS, and I don't know that anybody knows what to do now.
Larry Kramer, you've been right at the center of this for so long, co-founder of the Gay Men's Health Crisis and AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, ACT UP. I mean, these are groups we've been reading about for years. What is it that brought you out in November that has you out tonight talking about this with renewed urgency?
Well, George Bush got elected, basically, and I realized that it's going to be another 4 years of utter and sheer hell against gay people. We have no rights. They're going to take away the few we already have. They hate us. I don't know why gay people can't accept the fact or realize the fact we are hated. 60 million people voted against us on Election Day when they voted against the various referendums around the country.
So are you saying gay people, gay men, take responsibility for AIDS before...
Take responsibility for everything, your own life, your own community, your own brothers and sisters, and of course your own body.
And take responsibility before a U.S. government comes and implements measures, what, that will be...
They're already there. They're already there. We have a government that hates us. We have an endless number of new and old Congress people who hate us. They're passing bills right and left. It's going to be illegal for a lesbian to teach school, those kind of things. And we just sit back and let it happen. Nobody fights back. We have become, with good reason, I might add, a very sad, tragic, pathetic community.
And Larry Kramer says, stand up and take responsibility here. Larry Kramer, please stand by. We have to take a short break. We're talking tonight about a new wave of angst over AIDS and gay America, debating whether more radical intervention on sexual behavior may now be required. You can join the conversation tonight with HIV cases. AIDS cases soaring from 41 in the U.S. in 1981 to 70 million globally today. Is it time for more radical intervention? And like what? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about a new wave of angst over AIDS and gay America, debating whether more radical intervention on sexual behavior may now be required. Larry Kramer, playwright and AIDS activist, is with us tonight. You can join the conversation as well. Does the gay community have a responsibility to itself to more aggressively deal with this disease? Has the antiretroviral cocktail lulled the country into complacency as HIV/AIDS continues to spread? Is a new, untreatable super AIDS virus inevitable if unsafe sex is not aggressively reined in? Gay playwright Larry Kramer tells American gays, you are still murdering each other with unprotected sex. Is moral suasion enough to stop this epidemic? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I want to turn for a moment to San Francisco. We're joined from there by Stephen Tierney. He's director of HIV prevention for the San Francisco Department of Public Health. Stephen Tierney, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
You're welcome.
I wish you'd look back at the history of this with us for a moment. How was AIDS, from its onset, treated differently from syphilis, from TB, from other highly contagious diseases with great morbidity that America's dealt with in the past?
Well, I think there's a couple historical points, which is that it was a disease that originally was largely among gay men. And if you remember, we live in a very different world now than we did just 25 years ago. And there was massive discrimination in our large cities and across the country. And so there was a need to an AIDS or an HIV diagnosis was an indication that someone was very likely gay.
So it was a diagnosis and an outing almost at the same time when that was hard.
Right. And it had impacts on, family stability, on future insurability in terms of health insurance, in terms of job stability, which is where most people get their health insurance. So there was in the beginning a very strong need to protect anonymity and to design systems that would get people into care, was the original design, hopefully, to get people into care while protecting their anonymity and confidentiality.
How was that different from how syphilis was treated, how TB was treated?
Well, syphilis and TB, everybody gets, and having it doesn't mean that you are a member of a group upon whom society was openly at war at that time.
Right, right. And so what kind of measures were taken with those diseases?
Well,
we're not here.
The disease, syphilis, for instance, is in most jurisdictions, or all jurisdictions, a reportable disease. So that if you have syphilis, you are registered with the county that you live in, and the county public health department has a responsibility to work with you to follow up on possible contacts.
But that didn't happen with AIDS. Do you think, Stephen Tierney?
Let's just correct. It does happen. There's a program called Partner Counseling and Referral Services, which so it does happen. But because of the anonymity and confidentiality concerns, those programs are still largely voluntary with HIV.
As a public health official in San Francisco, is it your sense, Stephen Tierney, that the country, the culture, has reached a point now where it might be reasonable, even necessary, to be more aggressive in naming names, following up on individuals by name, to take away the anonymity, or is it still impossible?
I think that has to be the goal for all public health departments, is to eliminate new infections. Larry Kramer has written a very powerful letter that we use as part of our training here, trying to get people to really understand where we're at in this epidemic. I think until we have an administration in the country at the moment that has sort of brought the culture war back to our doorstep. And so I think we definitely want people to get tested. People who are sexually active should be tested every 3 months. People who have been tested should be in care and treatment. That presupposes that care and treatment is available to all those folks.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a rub, in terms of available funding and resources, not just in San Francisco and New York, but, across the country. And certainly in certain parts of New York, I would imagine, in certain neighborhoods in San Francisco, the care is less good than others. So the goal has to be people to get tested, people to notify their partners, people to be involved in disclosure, which Larry has spoken about, people mm-hmm. to be involved in disclosure. When you have sex with somebody, both parties have a responsibility to take care of their own health and the health of their sexual partners.
In a sense, normalize the response to what Larry Kramer and others call a plague.
Absolutely.
In public health terms. Stephen Tierney in San Francisco, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
You're welcome.
Larry Kramer is with us. Our own Jack Beatty is with us as well. Jack Beatty, you've been listening. You've read
Hello.
Larry Kramer's very powerful speech. You know the depth of the alarm he's raising here. What does it leave you thinking, Jack?
Well, first of all, I think everybody should read this powerful, passionate piece. It's hard reading at points because it has a kind of candor that we don't ordinarily hear about this, and I think that's one of the problems. I don't know that there's been enough candor about this disease. Certainly, look at our national leaders. President Clinton won all sorts of points from the right wing for his so-called sister soldier moment, where he, made a point about how ruinous, really, to young African American males, gangster rap, and that whole scene was.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was taken as, well, he's daring to say something that, preach a hard truth to his constituency. He said nothing like that about the immorality of having sex with someone, unprotected sex with someone, if you have HIV or if you're not certain whether you do or not. There was no, and there has been no, sister soldier moment for gay men. And until there is a sort of candor facing the moral dimension of this, it's hard to see how this can be stopped.
Larry Kramer, we hear your overall despair with the situation, and yet at the same time, it's not complete despair because you are challenging the gay community to step up here.
I don't know where to start. I've heard so many things I want to talk about and correct.
Please.
And all that. You talk as if there's a great deal of going on in the gay community about this. Like maybe 10 people have got upset and are talking about all of these things. I wouldn't call it, anger about changing things and everything. That's our major problem.
Mm-hmm.
Second of all, whoever complimented my speech, it will be published. It will be out. Penguin Books is publishing it. It will be out early April. Thank you for your kind
words. It's Jack Beatty, and it is a tremendous speech.
I guess I would like to say I don't think any government wants to do anything. I think it pays the government to have AIDS go on as long as it can. And I talk about that in the speech. That way they don't have to deal with gay people in any responsible way. All they can do is dump on us. They don't want this to get better. They don't want it to get better. There is not one president since 1981 who has done a damn thing. There's something like $6 billion been approved by Congress for Africa. less than 2% of that has been released to Africa. That does not sound to me like a president who wants to do anything. The extreme right wing in this country, controls the government. They hate us. They do not want to spend money on us. They do not care if we die. That is why it is so important that the gay community rise up in some sort of rebellion, and we don't. That's what drives me nuts, and it has driven me nuts since day one.
But the rebellion you're talking about includes a kind of self-examination. You said at the Cooper Union to your gay audience, yes, you cannot continue to allow yourselves and each other to act and live like this.
Indeed, I say it. But I've been saying it since 1981. You know, now they listen. In 1981, I was a pariah. People crossed the street rather than walk on the same side of the street with me. Everything in that speech is something that I have said since 1981. It's a little stronger now because I'm using the word murderer and murder more intentionally, because I think we really have to face up to the fact that everybody who doesn't use a condom is a potential murderer, and maybe that'll scare people a little bit more. I also want to say, if we had had our rights from the beginning, if we had been allowed to get married, if we had all the rights that straight people have, I do not think that AIDS would have happened in the first place. And I certainly do not think the plague would have happened to the extent that it has. When you are hated, of course you are depressed. Of course you need something like crystal meth to go out there and make yourself feel better. Of course you want to have abandoned sex. What else have we got left? And the straight world doesn't realize that. Why can't we get married like you? Why can't we be happy in a relationship that's protected by this country? It makes no sense.
So normalize that side as well, and that would be a big step. Larry Kramer, we hear the passion. I want to bring one more voice into this conversation, also from New York. Walter Armstrong is with us. He is editor-in-chief at PAS, a monthly magazine about AIDS and HIV. He's been an AIDS activist for 15 years. He's gay. He's HIV negative. Walter Armstrong, thanks for joining us tonight.
It's my pleasure.
Larry Armstrong has laid out a very big impassioned cry and kind of umbrella critique here. I think you've been more focused on the conversation going on in detail about the kind of taking responsibility that Larry and others, how many you tell us, are talking about. Is there an active conversation in some part of the gay community now about, I'm not sure how to describe it, about monitoring, about being more aggressive in intervening around carriers of HIV?
I think that Larry is right that there's a few people talking about it, but I do applaud Andrew Jacobs of The Times for having his ear to the ground and hearing that conversation. And I think that the way that the gay community seems to mobilize is to feel that its sexual freedoms are under attack from within.
Mm-hmm.
And to that extent, I think some of us who love the community very much, and I know Larry does, are using rhetoric that is intended to upset us and get people to rise up and feel that they are under attack in ways that may not be clear to them at the moment. Now, I will say that my own feeling as an HIV negative man, I feel that prevention that the gay community almost single-handedly has created over 20 years has been in many ways a success. And that at the current moment, it faces an enormous challenge. And the challenge is to include what the press is calling radical measures. And these radical measures, as I see it, are of two different kinds.
Mm-hmm.
One set has to do with traditional public health measures. Now, we can talk about that in detail. The other set has to do with things that the gay community on its own has been developing, which we've had no support from the government, and certainly in the current Bush administration, which the support that we've gotten for the so-called Prevention for Positives program initiated by the federal agency, the CDC, is absolutely laughable. All they want to do is test people. There's no support for explicit sexual information. Condoms have been completely lied about. They have contempt for science of prevention. So this is the larger climate that I think Some of us want the community to respond to at the same time that we respond to what's clearly a failure on our part to take responsibility for each other at this point in the epidemic.
So when people talk about curbing gay sexual freedom, you're saying that's in part theater, but when you talk about traditional public health measures, that suggests measures as well. What kind of measures?
Well, I see two different kinds of so-called radical measures. They're not so radical when you really consider them. Public health is a science. It's grounded in rationality, logic, and what has worked in other epidemics. And I guess what I'm talking about, to give you an example, and I want to make it clear that I'm advocating that the gay community itself embrace these measures and carry them out.
Not as public policy, but as private policy.
Yes, because I think it has to be done in an ethic of trust, compassion, understanding, and that gay men look to each other and they trade information in ways that we would never trust the government with our private information.
So measures such as what?
Well, just let me give you an example. One thing that we've already done and we did from the very beginning was routine screening and testing. Mm-hmm. It's part of almost any gay man's health care. Get tested for HIV 6 months, 3 months. We do that and we identify strongly as positive or negative. The next step is, I think, supports need to be put in place for disclosure.
And disclosure how? If it's not through government offices, how would that work?
Well, this existed at a time during ACT UP, at a time when the community was in crisis and when a true community spirit of courage existed. And I think that we need to recreate that. But what I'm asking for is for gay men who are HIV positive to disclose to their anonymous sex partners, to risk rejection, which they will experience mm-hmm. over and over again, and basically just to get over it. For HIV negative men, I would say they need to risk having sex with HIV positive men, having safe sex with them, and learning once again, as we learned 15 years ago, that safe sex truly works. If you use a condom, you will not get infected if you have sex with an HIV-positive man. Mm. We've forgotten that message. Mm.
Larry Kramer, we still see 40,000 cases of new infection per year. We read about a kind of epidemic of crystal meth use that's tied in with anonymous sex and multiple partners. The guy who came into New York with the so-called super AIDS virus last week, 100 partners or so in recent months. Is it enough in that kind of setting to expect not public intervention but private or personal measures to be taken?
I think it's an unanswerable question. I really do. I think what Walter says sounds fine. I don't know how you put it into practice. There's so many of us and so few willing to do the work, and we haven't been able to do it up till now. There's one thing we haven't talked about is that this is the first of what could potentially be many more. We haven't talked about the fact that there are 20 HIV drugs out there now, and the whole house of cards, I think, is going to come tumbling down. These drugs don't get along with each other in our bodies. The cocktails that we take create other problems, and people become resistant to the drugs, which makes some greedy pharmaceutical companies then invent another one, which is even stronger. Our bodies are bombarded by so many of these things that they just can't take it. We are taking chemotherapy every day for the rest of our lives, and that chemotherapy is getting stronger and stronger and stronger. Of course the virus is going to mutate into something like this man has, and of course it's just going to get worse and worse. And these are problems that I don't think public health can do anything about. People don't even know that they're getting resistant to drugs. People don't even know. Everybody who's on AIDS drugs now doesn't know that he is already taking too much or too little of every single drug he's taking. How do you test 8 zillion people for that to make sure that his cocktail is correct? The problems that we are beginning to face more and more are just totally insurmountable.
But in a period of the kind of political antipathy that you see out there...
Oh, political antipathy. It's been antipathetic since 1981. It's no different now, except that they hate us more visibly and more vocally.
But would you be willing to... Well, there we are. Jack, you feel the tensions that this is all riven with. I mean, tremendous paranoia of being abused by a political system that Larry Kramer sees as fiercely hateful toward the gay community. On the other hand, a disease that's just eating people up.
Yes, but you know, I think Walder gives us some of the language here of intimacy that's the right language. You know, on the one hand, for the person with who is positive, risk rejection. That's a tough thing to do.
Do it. Step up and risk it. Yeah.
Absolutely. And the person who's negative, risk safe sex. That's the kind of language, it seems to me, that can reach people. And I just think it's something like it's a tragedy within this compound tragedy that level of public education hasn't gone on. You know, we did 50% of the people used to smoke when I was a kid. Now it's 25% and going down. We did something right on that. Can't we do something comparable here?
Jack Beatty, Larry Kramer, Walter Armstrong, please stand by. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about a new wave of angst over AIDS and gay America, or at least a part of it, debating whether more radical intervention on sexual behavior may now be required. You can join the conversation tonight, and we will begin to get calls in here. I'm sorry to keep you waiting. Here, the question. Can America get tougher on AIDS without unleashing fresh hatred on gays? Has protecting confidentiality around AIDS, in effect, protected the disease? And what is gay America's responsibility in stopping this disease? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been joined tonight by playwright and gay AIDS activist Larry Kramer. He's been with us from New York. Also from New York, Walter Armstrong, editor-in-chief at PAS, a monthly magazine about AIDS and HIV. Right now we're joined from Berkeley, California, by Walt Odets. He's a clinical psychologist, author of In the Shadow of the Epidemic, Being HIV Negative in the Age of AIDS. Walt Odets, thanks for being with us tonight.
Hey, you're welcome.
So we see you quoted by Andrew Jacobs in the Times. You followed some of this conversation, the introspection, the notion of getting more aggressive in bringing traditional public health measures to AIDS, being more upfront, naming names, tracking carriers, and all the rest. As a psychologist who talks to people dealing with AIDS, how do you see this? Would it work? Is it necessary? Is it a good idea, bad idea?
Well, if I could, I'd like to provide a little bit of context.
Please.
Before I answer that. And I say this as someone who over the years have been largely known as critical of the way we've done prevention.
Mm-hmm.
I've often felt that we could have done a much better job. But the context is that if we're to believe the CDC figures, in the late 1980s, we had about 150,000 new infections a year.
Mm.
Today, we have about 40,000.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very significant improvement in an epidemic vectored through sexual behavior.
And yet, 70 million cases worldwide from 41 in the early 80s, that doesn't look like a good trajectory.
No. I mean, but we're talking here
in
this discussion about largely about what's going on in the United States with gay men.
Mm-hmm.
And that figure represents a big improvement. The second bit of context is that we have no idea how many of these new infections are occurring in what people are calling anonymous sex, or are occurring in conjunction with methamphetamine use. I've never seen any figures about that, but it's only part of the new infections. There are a lot of infections that are going on in relationships between gay men, and those are considerably different and emotionally more complex issues. So having said that, I do think there's a problem, and I do think we can do better. And I think the central problem that we've had in gay communities is that since we had the ELISA, the test for HIV antibodies in 1985, we realized that there were about half of us who had HIV and a half who didn't. And the immediate response, and I think a fundamentally good one, was to try to protect HIV-positive men from stigmatization.
Mm-hmm.
But it left us with a central paradox in doing prevention, and that is that every time we told a negative man that it was important to stay negative, it felt like we were somehow invalidating the lives of positive men.
Mm.
And that's a paradox that we gay men have never quite been able to resolve. and it's handicapped the way we've done prevention in our communities. It's handicapped addressing positive men more directly about their responsibilities in not transmitting HIV. And it's left us with what looks like a chaotic and angering and bewildering situation.
But you're quoted as saying it smacks of a witch hunt to ask more revelation from HIV carriers.
Well, I don't think I use the term witch hunt. I should say. Yeah, it may have been characterized that way. What I was responding to was a reporter's description, essentially, of policing, of a police model for prevention. And my first reaction to that is that policing is exactly what society has done probably for millennia about homosexuality itself.
Mm-hmm.
And it obviously exacerbates all of the issues of shame and minority among gay men. And it didn't work. It didn't work about homosexuality, obviously.
Mm.
And it's not going to work about the transmission of HIV. HIV is transmitted, by and large, in private behaviors. And what we do when we police things is that we empty the discussion, we shallow the discussion, rather than enriching the discussion. There are many reasons that people have unprotected sex. The idea that people get addicted to meth and then they have unprotected sex because they're taking meth is simplistic. The things that Larry mentioned about the society, about the stigmatization of gay men, really about the health issue of homophobia is a very important issue. This is a community that is living in a very beleaguered environment.
You've suggested gay men have used methamphetamines as an antidepressant.
Yes, I don't think there's any question about that. It's an excellent antidepressant with a lot of very bad side effects. And the ability to be effective only in the short term, but
and not a real great promoter of responsible safe sex.
No, it has, you know, it's transforming for a lot of people in ways that I think are extremely destructive.
Walter Detz, Walter Armstrong, Larry, please stand by. I want to begin to bring our callers in. They've been waiting patiently. John is calling from Boston. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Yes. Good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening. What's on your mind, John?
I've been infected with HIV. I have AIDS since 1985. When I was 20 years old.
Wow.
And I think that a stronger message to the gay community and the entire community at large is long overdue. I think there's been far too much coddling and, as the gentleman said, not enough candor.
So, what kind of measures would look reasonable to you?
Well, I was very happy to hear that in certain parts of Africa, their campaign now is abstain or die. And that sounds very black and white, but it's a very black and white situation.
Walter Armstrong, here's a vote from someone who's carrying it, and he wants much more toughness.
I guess I would ask him if he abstains and if he really thinks that it's healthy for human beings to truly abstain. I myself feel that I would rather risk getting HIV. It's not the end of the world, and have an enjoyable and interesting sexual life than do without.
John?
Yes, I do abstain. It's been almost 5 years, and I'd much rather be alive and maybe be a little bit sexually frustrated than be dead.
John, thanks for your call. Larry Kramer, what about that exchange and the dilemma that's laid out there?
They're both very painful, and they're both very harsh, and I think it's much too black and white to put it that way. I said at the beginning I haven't the vaguest idea what to do now. I really don't, and it's the first time since 1981 I've said that. I don't know what to do. I have no suggestions. Everything we have tried has not worked. I do not think that Walt's point about reducing from 150 to 40 is what I would call a major reduction, especially since so many people have already died in the gay world. So I don't think prevention has proved to be effective anywhere. I don't think you should stop, but I don't think we should continue to torture ourselves that we have that there's a new way to do it, and that we're not doing, and we have to make this or do that. Prevention is prevention, and it has only worked partially, and we're going to have to learn to live with that. And I don't know how you deal with the rest of them.
I guess I don't really agree with that in the sense that I do see prevention as an evolving thing. I think that Waldo Dett's early criticisms in the early 90s that basically said we need to keep HIV negative men uninfected, that we have been, in a sense, coddling HIV positive men, and we need to do real public health messages, do primary prevention that focuses on this group without stigmatizing positive men. I think that this is kind of the second wave of what Waldo Dett was trying to initiate.
I don't think we haven't been doing that already. I think that the message is pretty strong from public health about when they bother, about there's that this is all very life-threatening. What more can you say?
Well, the suggestion is to this notion of intervention, that when people see HIV...
How are you going to intervene in Podunk, Oklahoma? You know, there's tremendous infection outside of the major cities.
Yep.
How are you going to intervene there? Where are you going to get the staff? Most of the AIDS organizations are going broke and can't afford the staff they have.
Walter Armstrong, I have to say I remain kind of mystified about how this intervention would take place.
Okay, well, let me just give you an example. Yep. It may sound a very small change.
Okay.
But as the editor of PAWS magazine, I'm fortunate to have access to some of the top doctors in New York.
This is PAWS, sort of as in HIV positive.
Right. And I hear from a leading doctor that in the last month, half a dozen guys come to him newly infected, some young, some old.
Mm-hmm.
They were mostly using crystal meth. He tests their virus. He sees some resistance. It's not this so-called super virus,
yep,
which I personally don't believe in, but whatever. And as he sees a pattern in their virus, and he says, aha, let me talk to these guys. They went to this crystal meth party. So the three or four guys recognize each other.
Mm-hmm.
They all went to the party, and they think they know who infected them.
So what should be done?
Well, that's a good question, and I think that there are a couple of things that the gay community, that sort of rituals or systems can be set up where, I mean, I personally, if this guy was my friend who was infecting them, I would feel I had a responsibility to do something.
To put his name on a website?
I think, you know, okay, he's addicted to crystal meth. He's got a serious problem. Try to help him out. If that doesn't work, well, you do want to stop the reckless behavior. So maybe you stand outside of his apartment building, handing out flyers, handing out condoms, saying, if there's a party going on in here, you better protect yourself. Public shaming can go a long way. But I want to make clear that we're talking about a very small portion of the gay community that is out of control. And that is why this discussion can get dangerous, because
Right.
our enemies who are out there can start thinking that it's unsafe sex that's happening all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
The unsafe sex that Waldo Dett is talking about between two committed people is a completely different thing. And, you know, I would say that's not pathological. That's not crystal meth related. That has nothing to do with this.
But the call is to stand up and do something about what is, as you say, out of control. Rosemary's calling from Leonia, New Jersey. Hi, Rosemary. You're on the air.
Hi. Hello?
Yes.
Oh, should I speak now?
You're on, Leonia.
Oh, okay.
We're all ears.
Hi. It's just that, I mean, I'm no expert at this, and I'm thinking maybe what I'm going to say is oversimplistic, but sure, all this, all these suggestions about protection and what to do about the situation is sort of like micromanaging the crisis, but I really liked what one of the first gentlemen was talking about how society doesn't allow for the relationships to be free and open, and we don't condone it, so that gay people are put in this situation where they're forced into this frustrated situation.
Right. So there's a reality, and Larry Kramer frames it. But within that, a plague has grown. What do we do about it?
Well, it's just that I think that what happens is that it's the promiscuity that's a problem, not the gayness. So I understand that it's very linked, but I think we have to change everybody's way of looking at it, not just gay people's.
And look at the promiscuity, and we absolutely understand it, and we see it right beyond the gay borders. Rosemary, thanks for that. Walt Odets, what about the promiscuity? Is that a necessary part of the picture here? Is it necessary to cut down on that to get a handle on the plague, as Larry Kramer called it?
Well, the promiscuity is an issue is a complicated one, but promiscuity with protected sex doesn't transmit much HIV,
mm-hmm.
and so I'm not sure that the levels of sex are the issue. What we see in gay men is young male sexuality, which is unfettered by the sensibilities of women.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's probably normal sexual expression. I wanted to, if I may, back up just a step.
Yes.
I can't say that I can by any means completely answer Larry's bewilderment about where to go. But I do think there's a whole kind of discussion that we have not done in prevention education for gay men. And I'll give you just a single example. From the beginning, we've prohibited unprotected sex as unsafe and bad. And what that has done is put people in the closet about having unprotected sex. And the fact is that people get benefits from it, or they feel that they get benefits from it.
Mm.
And in opening up that discussion in the community, men can then make much more conscious decisions about the benefits and about the risks and express their values in their behaviors in a more conscious kind of way.
I want to turn, if I may, because we've only got a minute and a half left, to Larry Kramer. Larry, you say you don't know what to do about this, but you've raised it in such a powerful kind of prophetic way, surely not for no reason. I mean, this is a call. It's a call for something. What are you asking for?
I don't know. I'm asking for everybody to rise up and somehow find leaders to lead them and somehow people to speak what we want to need to be said. I made a similar speech in whatever year it was that made ACT UP form, and ACT UP got the drugs. So I don't see any response except the same bewilderment that I have. We have no leaders. We have no organizations that are really any good anymore. Not that we ever had them, but they were that good. This is a leaderless community, a powerless community, an awful lot of rich people, and I mean really rich people, not putting a dime into the community. That's what we really need, the rich people to come out there and pump money in it. That's what fuels the religious right, is their money. All these foundations, Coors and people like that.
Mm-hmm. And within that, a sense that this cannot, must not go on, even if the way is not clear. Larry Kramer, we're very grateful to you for being with us tonight. Thank you very much for joining us. And Walter Armstrong, editor-in-chief at PAWS magazine, thank you for being with us. And Walt Odets, clinical psychologist in Berkeley, California, thank you for joining us. Jack Beatty, tough situation here, but a stirring of something new.
Yes, and just to hear the urgency, even if baffled, in Larry's voice is somehow moving and something I think people need to hear.
It is. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio. Support for On Point.